so I really started seeing the pattern then about how it's really all to do with control of women's bodies and control of the space of birth, and try to understand how we give that space back to women. You know, I think that's the ultimate goal for me, is give the space back to women, make sure that she's actually, obviously she's not wanting to control that space at that time because she's busy doing other stuff, but we need to make sure that it isn't somebody else's space.
Welcome to Contractions, a podcast about the politics of midwifery, wherein midwives labor through political ideas. Contract utopic visions into our ears. And where every pain brings us closer to better birth. In our first contraction, Elizabeth Newnham focuses on the constellation of power and knowledge in midwifery and obstetrics. Newnham is a midwife and academic researcher and teacher at the University of Queensland, Australia. She is the author of the book Towards the Humanization of Birth, a study of epidural analgesia and hospital birth culture. What sustains her passion for midwifery is that she stands in awe of childbirth. My name is Rodante. I'm a midwife myself, although my motivation to become one came forth out of something very different than Elizabeth, her desire. This is Contraction 1, Power Knowledge.
I became a midwife because I had a baby first. And I was 22 and I was 2 years into a politics degree and I had a baby, went through the birth centre. So it wasn't a continuity model, but it had that birth centre kind of philosophy. So I hadn't met the midwife who I met when I went in labour to have this, my son. But I remember her to this day. And I remember she put her hand on my knee like this. Her name was Isabel, and I just had a kind of, you know, a usual first labour, so it was fairly long, and I got in the bath, and that was amazing, and I had my partner with me and a couple of friends, and gave birth in a squat at 5 o'clock in the morning and just went, oh, my God, that was amazing. You know, I want to do that again, and how can I get closer to this experience without having to have lots and lots of babies, which I did actually end up then having three more children. But it was like something just came to me, you know, a sense of the power and that I wanted to be involved in that in some way. It had such positive connotations for me. Well, just those things that you see in women when they give birth in that way, there was a sense of awe, of connection to something bigger, and maybe that's just all the other women that have ever had babies before. You know, there's that sense of it being a deeply embodied experience as well, and the way that that then sets you up for motherhood.
Not everybody longs to give birth, but for Elizabeth, it was always going to be a positive, affirmative, and powerful experience.
Some of that now is confused with how I think as a midwife, you know, because obviously they're blended together. But one of the things that happened before that when I was pregnant was I got my hands on Ina May Gaskin's Spiritual Midwifery. It was just by chance. It kind of just came across my path. And I read that book and I thought to myself, this is something that I can look forward to. You know, labor and birth is something that is going to be an incredible experience and probably a hard experience, but not a bad experience. And I think that stuck with me as well. And then the further I got into my training and as I got into the hospital system, I wasn't seeing that. I wasn't seeing the power and I wasn't seeing the awe and I wasn't seeing that connection. I guess that's when I started asking questions about what's happening in the system? What is happening that we are losing this, or maybe have we lost it? You know, I don't think we've lost it. but we're definitely at risk of losing those positive parts of birth.
After becoming a midwife and working in a hospital, Elizabeth took up her political science degree, did a master and PhD, all to answer the question, how did we come in a situation where we are at risk of losing the awe of childbirth? She found out that it had to do with the submergence of midwifery into obstetrics and the loss of midwifery as an independent praxis and philosophy.
I mean, it took me back to the historical control. So there's quite a lot of evidence about why midwifery was opposed. In Australia, we've got the Indigenous birthing practices, which the Aboriginal women had been doing for thousands, tens of thousands of years, very successfully. And they supported the immigrants. When it started being colonised, certainly in some of the books I've read, if it hadn't been for the Indigenous women supporting the white women, the European women, when they came, then they would have actually been, you know, in dire straits, because they used local things for heat and antiseptic and that kind of stuff. They had various plants and things. So if you think about what happened, women would have come over to Australia. They mostly would have been granny midwives in that situation. So experienced women who had just done a lot of support of women during birth. Then the nursing profession started, and their midwifery got very quickly sucked in under nursing. Basically, what we had in Australia was the legacy of the UK without the strong, educated women who had been fighting for midwifery there. So we've got a convict history, we've got a history of uneducated women being transported to Australia, and so they were quite powerless to begin with. So then that got brought in under nursing, brought in under medicine, and there was very little to go on from there. So really, when we're talking about historical context in Australia, it comes back to the UK. And what happened there and in other parts of Europe was that the midwifery, it was decimated basically by obstetrics or the church. Now, the reason I think that happened is because having that as women's business gave women access to knowledge and power that they wouldn't have otherwise had. So, you know, who's having a miscarriage, who's trying to have an abortion, you know, if there's any kind of paternity issue of who's the father, then midwives and women know that stuff, and the men are kind of on the outside. And if we think back to that time, you know, women couldn't own property, they couldn't. And again, I'm not sure what it was like here. It may be different. But it was about that power and control over all of it. Anything to do with women or their bodies or how they were having babies or not having babies or whether they could or couldn't have babies was, you know, needed to be somehow controlled. I don't think it was a conspiracy. I think it was partly the time. So women just didn't have the same rights. You know, the gender struggle was quite obvious back then. But definitely the plan to get rid of the midwife by the obstetric profession was planned. And when I was doing my honours thesis, I went back to documents that either looked at some of these old journals or some of the old journal articles themselves, and they would be very open about the midwife problem. What are we going to do about it? We have to get rid of these pesky midwives who are trying to, you know, come back into our patch, because it was very lucrative as well. And if a doctor could get that woman, especially the general practitioners in Australia, then they had her for the baby, you know, that it was kind of like this lifelong patient. I think, again, we have to separate the individual from the systemic, and we have to do this all the time, because I'm sure that, and well, I know that there were doctors who worked very well with midwives who may have supported, you know, home birth and midwives doing their thing, and but the medical system was very anti-midwife. And when you look at the mortality rates in the early lying-in hospitals in England and Ireland. Not so sure about Australia because that was a bit later. But when they brought those hospitals in, the mortality rates were terrible. They were so much higher than the women who were having babies at home with midwives. But that was never talked about. So that, I guess, that is part of that whole systemic issue, is some things are talked about. Things that were happening in the midwifery world were made to sound, you know, as if they were bad practices. The things that were happening in the hospitals weren't discussed at all, things like high mortality rates. And I think that legacy remains.
So this elimination of independent midwifery resulted in an appropriation of childbirth by the industrialized obstetric institution, changing childbirth fundamentally. Its temporality, its environment, its nature, and the experience of it.
So the momentum of the institution became much more important, and the rhythm of labor was actually not really thought about at all, other than to make it speed up in line with that institutional rhythm. But it was like the system itself was trying to get them out. You know, you get them in and you get them out because any kind of delay in this kind of, you know, factory, if you want to call it that, causes a, you know, if it stops for any reason, there's this going to be this whole other commotion. There's going to be something is going to happen. It's got this momentum that needs to keep going. And that idea that something is going to stop that momentum, like a longer labor or a woman being induced and letting things try and take their own time for a bit rather than putting the Syntocin on up straight away. So the momentum of the institution became much more important. To be fair, some of that is about catastrophic maternal events or neonatal events that do happen in this setting, and which I have to say that is where the rhythm of the institutional rhythm kicks in and does its best work. You know, that is when you want institutional rhythm happening, and it is very fine. But the amount of women that have to go through that process in order to catch the one woman who actually really needs that, I don't think it's working. I think it's putting too many women at risk. And, yeah, this sense that if that does get blocked somehow, we cannot listen to the rhythm of the woman, because that is going to, the whole thing is going to kind of explode. It was the underlying message in a way. If you think back to birth physiology, hormones, the things that we know about stress, fear, oxytocin, adrenaline, endorphins, what kind of an environment are we expecting women to give birth in? One that is got fear up to its eyeballs, is completely stressed, can't cope with the pressure of the momentum, but can't possibly slow it down. And it's completely incongruous with everything we know about birth physiology. I mean, I just think women should not be giving birth in hospitals unless they need that for some reason. And some women will, and that's fine. But I think it is the least appropriate place for a woman to have a baby, particularly in these big hospitals that are only about fear and pressure and not about, you know, if we come back to that story of my own first birth and the influence of the spiritual midwifery book, I mean, that is universes apart, isn't it?
One of the most important struggles that we face today is that we organize maternity care in the way that we know as midwives is not the right one. And paradoxically, while what we know to be right and have proven in research to be right, like midwifery-led models of care or home birth with an independent midwife for low-risk women, is still seen in many countries and cultures as wrong.
And that certainly came out of the work that I did. The way that things are labelled as safe or risky has less to do with whether the actual practice is safe or risky, and more to do with whether it fits in with the obstetric model or not, you know. So they never said, when they started those hospitals, they never said your chance of dying if you come to this lying in hospital is 30% more than if you have your baby basically in the street or anywhere else. You know, that was never spoken about. And I think that's where we have to start. We have to start with actually these practices that we put in place maybe 200 years ago, maybe 100 years ago, maybe 50 years ago, that have never been evaluated. We called them safe because they fit within a particular framework, actually were never safe to begin with. And then we can't get rid of them. You know, the idea that you might be safe for having your baby outside of a hospital is still, even with all the research that we have today, is still being debated, you know. The sort of rhetoric of hospital safety, which is 300 years old, you know. The hospital is the best and safest place to give birth. Why would you have a baby anywhere else? And yet the practices that happened within the hospital because it had so many women giving birth there and couldn't give individualized care, put women at risk. So the throughput, the problem of bed block, of having too many women in, of needing to get women delivered and out of the door and up to postnatal ward and continuing with inductions that weren't necessary because the kind of machine was in motion, theoretically put them at risk. Now, obviously, because it was a qualitative study, I didn't do outcomes, so I can't say it put them at risk in terms of this, that, and the other. But we know that all of these intervention rates are going up. We know that induction rates are going up, so their C-section rates are going up. And I think it's because of this paradox. What it says is safe is risky, potentially. What it says is risky is actually going to ensure women's safety. Things like, you know, individualized continuity of care supports normal physiological birth. And then that filtered again into the way that practices were talked about. So, again, that paper about the epidural and the water showed very strongly that practices that fit within this medical model were seen as safe without any kind of critical thinking about what risk they actually posed. And the practices that didn't, like a woman hopping in a bath, which she can actually do at home with no anaesthetist or any kind of preparation or risk, was seen as and presented as a very risky practice that women had to kind of sign their soul away in order to do it. And it had really limited access, and the epidural had all of the access. So it's part of that, part of Foucault's theory of power knowledge is that the people that get to create the knowledge maintain the power. So what happens is everything that happens historically is treated as if it's some kind of automatic knowledge building exercise. You know, this idea that progress just goes along this line and we're going to get to some place where we know everything. And what Foucault did was kind of look through a microscope at particular moments in time and show how it was actually a struggle of knowledges, and everything that we know is actually really who won that struggle. That's his idea of genealogy, is saying things could have been different. If this discourse had won that knowledge struggle, then actually midwifery would be right now in our context, and obstetrics would be wrong. So it's not necessarily about truth at all, or it's about power. So once you have that framework, you can really see how obstetrics works to maintain its discourse. The reason that it hangs midwives out to dry, that it ridicules midwifery practice, that home birth is still being called dangerous, is because that's how it maintains its dominant discourse. If it lets that knowledge be legitimate, then it loses ground. And again, this is not a conscious, these are not conscious actions, obviously. They are systems of thought that are trying to maintain, and it's people. So the other thing that Foucault says is that because of this power knowledge, but also because he saw power as being rather than top down, like the old, you know, well, like any kind of power framework really that says all the power's at the top, like with the king or the government or the system, and then it trickles down to the individual. He said actually power runs in a horizontal way, kind of circulates. And so every interaction that we have is a potential for that struggle to continue, which means it's also potential for resistance.
Midwives are not only victims of the system, however. They are also complicit to the system and they sustain it.
What I think is that midwives are in a really difficult place because of what we were just talking about. So midwives are positioned as, by, you know, the medical power structure, as kind of illegitimate practitioners in a way. And the midwifery discourse is seen as a subjugated discourse, or, you know, the one that's kind of at the bottom. So midwives who speak out are at risk of deregistration or being reported. Part of Foucault's power theories is this idea about surveillance. So as we moved from one government system to another, so we went from a sovereign power, and again, he's obviously European focus here, a sovereign power that used force and the relationship was between the king or whatever and the individual, to a government, a parliament or slash government, who uses governmentality and surveillance to control the populations. So again, it went from individual to populations, and it went from sort of government by force to government by surveillance. And he used this imagery of a prison where there's a guard in the central tower. The prisoners are all in the cells surrounding the tower, and they potentially being observed at any given moment, but they don't know when they are going to be observed. Therefore, they behave in a certain way all the time. That's the kind of the short version. So any kind of institution, Foucault argued, has this surveillance. Anything that collects information about an individual and is one-sided, so the institution gets the information, the individual doesn't get any. So prisons, schools, hospitals, obviously, was a big one. And in fact, the old Nightingale Ward, you could almost say, is a like a panopticon, you know. And you can really see that clearly. Like when I was doing my research, you could hear midwives saying things like, I ruptured the membranes with that vaginal examination because I knew they would want me to do it. Or if I don't do this, they are going to know about it. Like, who's the they? You know, and so this sense of always being observed. I do try and say that we can't just dichotomize the two professions. We can't say obstetrics is bad, midwifery is good, particularly because of this idea that midwives do collude in that process. That ties in with our responsibility as midwives to resist, to make changes, to advocate for women. But the idea that midwives can resist, and I think it's difficult, but I think because I believe that midwifery is a feminist profession, because it's about power and control of women's bodies, I think we must resist. We talk about empowering consumers and the fact that we need women to be the voice to get parliamentarians to listen, and I think that's partly true. Women don't necessarily know what they're walking into, and you hear that all the time, don't you? I had my first baby. I believed this and this and this. Nobody told me that and that and that, and now I've suddenly realised that that whole experience was terrible and it didn't have to be like that. But we know, you see, and I think we have a responsibility to call it out every single time we see it. And if every midwife called it out every single time we saw it, then things would change. And that's where the resistance comes in, every single time, whether it's teaching a student or being with a woman or having a conversation with a colleague or an obstetrician, wherever we are, I keep just coming back to those just small parts of practice where, I mean, some tiny things like getting proper consent, like, vaginal examinations are a really clear one, I guess, because it is such a violation of a woman's personal space. And I don't know what it's like for you, but certainly I would have seen as a midwife, other senior midwives or doctors doing vaginal examinations, not necessarily without consent, although maybe. I mean, doing a quick check as a woman is fully dilated because the area is so, there's so much going on that women don't necessarily sort of feel it in the same way. I remember a particular example of a registrar continuing with a vaginal examination when the woman was telling him to stop. So the idea that consent is something that you have to keep negotiating rather than, you know, I don't think consent is a one-off thing. It's an ongoing relationship in a way. I suppose for me, things like speaking up and saying that woman has said stop, you need to stop. So what an example of resistance would be for me is saying, no, I'm not going to do this rupture of membranes at the same time as I'm doing a vaginal examination because it's not best practice. And I don't care what kind of trouble they are going to put me in, but I am not going to do that. I don't know. Mm. I mean, that seems like a simplification of all of these things, but, I mean, that's how I see it happening, and midwives supporting each other in that, you know, and the work that Mavis Kirkham has done in that space is that midwives don't feel supported in that. They hide those practices. They feel like the only one that's doing them, and they feel really vulnerable. So how do we resist by supporting each other to not collude in the medicalization of birth? You know, so there's this real interlaid complexity of modern social and cultural life that means it's very easy for women to feel like that's going to be the best option. How do we let women know about it? I think is to change the system. You know, I think we need to provide the kind of place for all women that is going to first of all support birth physiology, give midwifery continuity of care, allow space and time for birth to happen, have water and other kinds of things available for everybody. I think we need to really reconfigure how we see birth, where birth happens, so that every woman has a chance to feel awe and triumph and joy when they've had their first baby.
So because of the war of knowledges that obstetrics won, we, as midwives, also need to provide a strong alternative knowledge of childbirth.
And I was just saying this to a friend of mine the other day who isn't a midwife, and I was, you know, going on as I do about stuff, and I was explaining to her that the first midwives with PhDs are still in our living memory. I mean, they're still alive. They're still here doing research. The first professor of midwifery in the UK is still there doing things. Same within in Australia. It's all really so recent. But look at the changes that have happened in that last 20 years. Maybe not so much in practice, but absolutely in our knowledge base. And I think it's crucial. And I think that midwives doing research and asking questions that only midwives are going to ask, I think it really does have the potential to change. Now, then there's evidence, and how do we transform that into practice change? That's an issue. Culture is an issue because we believe the evidence that fits within our belief system. So you can sit there and talk till you're blue in the face to the obstetric lead in a hospital who's just going to say, I don't believe that research. I believe this other thing that, you know. So it's not the answer, but it is, we are lost without it. Um, how do we change it as midwives? I think, first of all, we need to be political. I think midwives need to be part of their professional association. They need to be vocal. So whether that's responding to things they see in the media or going to see their local member of parliament or whatever it is, I think that's really important. I think it's a long, slow struggle. I think we need to be persistent. In fact, Mary Newburn uses a phrase that I think it was Jean de Klerk said in one of the ICM conferences, which was of being a persistent activist. You know, this is not about short sprints or thinking that things are going to happen straight away. You know, it is long-term, strategic, small changes, and we need to conserve our energy and we need to be bringing up the midwives that are coming under us. We need to support them. We need to politically activate them. We need to be kind of, you know, gathering the forces, as my boss, Professor Jenny Gamble, would say. You know, gather the forces. We need to make this happen. It's not going to be a quick thing.
Thank you for being with us through our first contraction. If you want to give us continuous support, strengthen our moaning, and care for us like a true midwife by being present and listening in during our birth pangs, then please stay with us for the next one. Like and subscribe, leave a review, and circulate this podcast to your midwifery contacts. In our next contraction, Rebecca Ashley labors through midwifery, workload, and the financial crisis.